Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Meaning that under Hunt, we're still expecting the same amount of borrowing. Not only that, analysts from Citi expect the number to be over $250 billion of borrowing for the next 3 years running, showing that it's not just going to be about this year's borrowing, but look, we have to take into account this is going to be 2, 3, 4 years of high borrowing from the UK government.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Well, that was Bloomberg chewing over the high level of government debt issuance. This week, what does the government propose to do about it? Well, one thing they have done is open up the purchase of government bonds on the primary market to retail investors. Now, the UK isn't alone in doing this. It happens in other parts of the world. But what exactly does it mean? Why are they doing it? And what are the consequences? We'll look at all of that this week on the Debunking Economics Podcast. Well, as you no doubt know, when the government has debt, it issues bonds to cover that debt so their balance at the Bank of England doesn't go too far into the red because they've issued those bonds. And those bonds are sold to banks and other institutional investors who might sell them on, but the initial buyers are usually banks. And banks buy them with money that they have sitting in reserves, in their own accounts at the Bank of England, in other words. And as we've said before, there's never a shortage of interest in buying UK government bonds, which are called gilts, by the way. They're called bunds in Germany, treasuries in America, but now the UK Treasury, for whatever reason, are making gilts available to retail investors on the primary market through retail investment platforms. They're using a dealer called Winterflood Securities, and you know, great name, Winterflood Securities, given you know evidence of climate change this northern winter. But Steve, I mean, the official line on this from the UK Debt Management Office, which is the office responsible for issuing bonds and managing the auctions that where they're sold. They said they have been exploring the potential for retail investors to contribute more significantly to meeting the overall financing requirement. In other words, they fear there's not going to be enough interest in new bond issuances because they are issuing so much more of it. That just seems a bit unlikely, doesn't it? I mean, they never have any difficulty selling these bonds.
It just shows what happens when you have neoclassically trained people running the bloody country. It's ridiculous. That's the only way to describe it. They don't understand the actual mechanics of bond financing in the very first instance. And this is textbook economics. Textbook neoclassical economics teaches you complete fallacies about government finances. And then people who believe these complete fallacies become the people who run government finances and then do things based on the beliefs of those fallacies. So it's just ludicrous. Mm. It's just ludicrous.
So what they're saying, I mean, the financing requirement for 2024-25 next year, is going to be £277 billion, which is 16% higher than the financial year that we're just about to the end of. So their fear is... Well, I presume their big fear really is there's going to be less interest with so much more. So that's going to lower prices, and we'll explain why. But lower prices means higher yields. That's their fear, isn't it? They're trying to keep the yields down. And they think, well, if we can broaden the spread of buyers and we can get some retail investors, then maybe they'll put the price up. I can't help feeling they're thinking, well, they'll put the price up because they don't really know what they're doing. So we'll get a better price. Do you think that's what they're thinking now? I'm assuming that's what they're thinking.
Probably. I mean, I haven't got the actual link to this, but I'll give a recommendation for people to have a look at this straight away to get a deep understanding of how the financial system from the government point of view actually works. And this is three people I know moderately well, Andrew Berkeley, Richard Tye, and Neil Wilson, wrote a paper called An Accounting Model of the UK Exchequer. And they explain the actual mechanics of government financing. And And I've reproduced this, not their entire, very, very detailed, this 213-page document for those who are considering reading it. Not the incredible detail I've gone into in that document, but the basic principles. And there is absolutely no possibility of the UK in particular and governments in general who issue debt in their own currency, absolutely no possibility of not having the potential buyers not having sufficient funds to be able to buy all the bonds the government itself issues. Given the nature of government financing, how it works out, there's zero possibility. Absolutely zero possibility. There won't be the funds available. There can be dilemmas caused by other stupid policies, such as putting up interest rates, which then reduces the value of bonds and damages the asset side of the banks that is supposed to buy them, and it makes it a bit of a please put your hand in this mouth trap. So I can understand that reluctance. We'll talk about that during the show, but it is 100% guaranteed. The funding will be available if the government issues bonds to match the scale of its deficit plus outstanding interest payments on outstanding bonds.
Because there's so much money sitting in bank deposits, within the reserve, of
not
banks.
Not even that. But this is the other point. This is why it's, you have to know the mechanics overall. And every time, the trouble is I'm so used to this stuff that I obviously get outraged to have the very idea that there can be a problem, which clearly there's people who are issuing these bonds to retailers actually believe there can be. So I get outraged at its stupidity. And I dive in, and you can see how ridiculous I think this is. But so I'm thinking in terms of four interlocking double entry balance sheets. And the fundamental one is the central banks, because the central bank's capacity to buy existing bonds currently owned, whether it's by the private sector or by the banking sector, the capacity to buy existing bonds is limitless. So if for example, let's say there's £100 trillion pounds worth of outstanding bonds, which is ridiculous, I know, I just want to use an exaggerated figure, then the Bank of England can say, oh, we'd like to buy those bonds off you, our dear private bank and non-bank bondholders. We will pay you $1.1 trillion. This is the big over. $1.1 trillion. We'll give you for those bonds, and so they say we're going to put the numbers $1.1 trillion in your banking accounts, and those banking accounts can either be the reserve accounts of the private banks at the Bank of England, or it can be the deposit accounts of individuals who bank with banks, not non-banks who bank with banks. No difficulty in doing either of those. These 1.1 trillion. Oh dear, we've got a deficit of 100 billion. Okay, so having given you 1.1 trillion, you now have 1.1 trillion in your reserve accounts. Would you like to use, one tenth of that to buy 100 billion worth of outstanding bonds? The mechanics and even people who know as little about the financial sector as Ben Bernanke, and I'm going to let that hang for a moment, as Ben Bernanke, if I can quote my mate George Galloway's intonation, even he understood that.
Ben.
Because he was actually –
Bernanke.
I
love the fact, by the way, for those in the UK, he just as we're recording this actually the morning after he won the Rochdale by-election, and he said because it was a Labour were trounced basically because the Labour candidate had been disgraced from conspiracy theory and the like, and George Galloway said Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak are both two cheeks of the same backside, and they well and truly got spanked tonight. Seamus stuffed up the line, but that's just classic George Galloway, isn't it?
That's wonderful, wonderful stuff.
Anyway, we've completely lost your train now.
I haven't, because I'm on this train.
Back on the train.
And that is Ben Bernanke was asked about, what would what can the government do with its finances before the financial crisis? And he said the government has this technology called a printing press. Now that's the only mistake he made, because it's not printing press; it's double entry bookkeeping, which enables it to produce a limitless amount of money. Now, but what happens is bonds are there. The number of bonds which are outstanding right now In other words, bonds which are owned by either the banking sector or the non-bank private sector, which can include other financial institutions, non-bank financial institutions.
Yeah, like pension funds and the like.
That is the sum total of the what we call government debt. Now, let's say in the UK's case, I'm not sure the actual numbers because, you know, I know the private debt numbers much better than I know the public, because private debt's what actually bloody matters, which these idiots ignore. But say government's at 100% of GDP. I know it's more than that. 100% of GDP. What's your deficit? Even if your deficit is 25% of GDP. Since the Bank of England can literally tell, let's say all the debt's owned by the private banks that have accounts at the Bank of England. The Bank of England can decide to say, we're going to buy all the outstanding government bonds, which is 100% of GDP. That then means that the bond holding, and then they'll offer a deal. This is to some extent the way the central banks operate as a mafia. They can make an offer too good to refuse. So they can, you know, they could say, we're going to buy them at par or buy them above par. It doesn't matter. But okay, let's say above par, 10% above par. You've got bonds outstanding worth 100% of the UK's GDP. We're going to pay you 110% of the GDP. You'd be an idiot to turn that deal down. All they have to do, and both Bernanke and Greenspan have said themselves at various times, is type the number 1.1 times GDP into the bank, into the deposit accounts of the private banks at the central bank, which are a liability of the central bank, and then that requires the banks to hand over the bonds back to the Bank of England. So what happens is, in terms of looking at the private bank accounts, they've got no reserves, which is quite feasible. That's usually quite a near operating situation. Suddenly, they've got reserves worth 1.1 times, 110% of GDP. Then the government issues bonds for, say, a deficit of 10% of GDP and says, oh, we can convert 10% of that, or 9% of that outstanding amount of reserves you have into interest-earning bonds. Would you like the deal? And the answer is yes, please.
Yeah.
So rinse and repeat
as required. But I mean, what you've described there is QE, isn't it? That's exactly what happens with QE.
Well, QE was just the usual government, the usual buying of the central bank on steroids. So, and this is why I'm going to get people.
But
to
what's the difference? Because they're saying with the situation you've described. The central bank is saying, yeah, we'll buy up your bonds, we'll give you a good deal for it, and we'll put it on our balance sheet. What's the difference between what you've described and what QE is?
Absolutely none. Just right. Scale.
Yeah.
That's all the difference. So the usual approach of the government, and like my good mate Ty Keynes, is to properly describe himself as the world's greatest Minsky modeler, has put a model of this together in Minsky. So we might actually whack that up on the Patreon and Substack website so people can see it. But the basic story is I'll go through the four accounts because that's what I'm seeing in my head. You have the Treasury, and the Treasury, whether it's planned it or by circumstances, spending is greater than taxation, and let's say it's 10% greater. And then it's got to, I'll ignore the interest payments, but the interest payments are just another step in exactly the same process. Actually, I'll include them in. I won't specify that. 10% of GDP is your deficit. That then means that they put money equivalent to 10% of GDP into private bank accounts, because if the spending exceeds taxation by 10% of GDP, then 10% of GDP turns up as additional money in people's deposit accounts, whether that's individuals or non-bank financial institutions or companies, that's where it turns up. The balancing side of that on the private bank's ledger is an increase in reserves of the same amount of money. And then you can say the government is then required to issue bonds. So the Treasury then issues bonds equivalent to 10% of GDP. They are then sold in an auction process. And the money which is used to pay for them is actually the reserves that have been created by the deficit. Now, people often say, oh, you've got to, it's the other way around. Well, if it is the other way around, you then have this, you know, outstanding stock of what, at least 100% of GDP worth of bonds already owned by the non-bank, the banking sector and the non-bank private sector. So all the central bank has to do, and it's required to support the Treasury in these operations, is to then go and buy those bonds off the banks themselves and the public, the private sector is. I mean, we use these terms in a confusing way. So they buy off them, and that then means the reserves rise by, guess what, 10% of GDP. So suddenly when the auction is required to be held, all the potential buyers have the available funds in reserves, which reserves you used not to get interest on. Now you get a lower rate of interest than you get on bonds. So there's an interest rate differential. The bond will offer a higher interest rate. And you can't trade and speculate on the value of reserves when the bond market is by far the biggest financial market in the world, and banks are trading and gambling on the value of bonds all the time. So the offer to convert those reserves, which have been created for you by the central bank buying existing bonds off you previously, the opportunity to convert those back into interest-earning bonds, which you can trade, the banks take it.
So
there's no possibility. It shows how ignorant the people are who put this idea together.
Well, I wonder whether there's an ulterior motive, which we'll come on to that. But in that situation that you've described, where the money ultimately, the bonds are ultimately being bought up by the central bank, which is releasing more reserves, which can then be used for the next tranche of government, to buy up the next tranche of government debt. In all of that, of course, the government is spending, so money is going into people's bank accounts. So it's expanding the money supply. The government spending is expanding the money supply, isn't it, in effect?
Yeah, well, this is the reason
I'm asking that question is because I'm wondering what happens if it's not banks that are buying it, because if the extra money is being bought, is being used to buy those bonds by the consumer, then that's not expanding the money supply.
It's reducing it, yeah. Mm. This is why I say it's so ignorant. When you sell those bonds to the non-bank private sector, then their deposit accounts go down by that, which means the amount of money in circulation goes down. In return, they get an asset, which is the bond, which on which they'll earn interest over time. And that's a polite way of putting it, the naive belief that mainstream economists have that this is the same thing as you going and getting a loan from the private bank is just nonsense when you look at the actual mechanics of it. But the crazy thing is, I've been used to this delusion being commonly held, and I thought that was possibly the way that people issuing war bonds thought during the Second World War. But Nathan Tankus, who's done a lot of brilliant original research, found the documents that explain the policies behind issuing war bonds, for example, and the people who were selling, which, and that includes Charlie Chaplin during the Second World War, realized the purpose of selling the bonds was not to finance the war. It was to reduce the amount of money in the private sector so that there'd be less competition from non-war demand for goods during the war effort, so you'd have more for building tanks and ships and so on. And that was part of the idea to control the inflation, which had been very bad during the First World War. So if you want to deflate the economy, if you want to reduce the level of economic activity, this is a bloody good idea. And what is Britain in right now? It's in a recession.
Yeah, but it's also got inflation. So maybe that's part, you know, maybe they're smarter than we think they are.
No, I very much doubt it. If they've been through a mainstream economics degree and they've learnt this garbage, then that's probably what's lying behind the decision making.
Right, but I mean, it is a point, isn't it? I mean, we've spoken about this before, that, you know, when inflation was high during the pandemic, because we had so much spare cash that just wasn't rotating around the economy, you know, the ideal thing would be to have that money taken aside and spent later, and the easiest way to do that would be to issue bonds. You know, say, okay,
that's the function of issuing bonds to the non-bank sector is to reduce the amount of money in the accounts and reduce the amount of potential demand pressure on the economy when it's highly demand constrained.
Right.
But we're not in a demand constrained economy right now, and I've got a feeling in UK's inflation problems got more to do with supply chains and lack of domestic manufacturing than anything else.
I'm sure you're right. And look, you know, and funnily enough, that reason wasn't given by the Debt Management Office. They said it was more about,
oh my God, they must be hiding what they know.
The potential for retail investors to contribute more significantly to meeting the overall financing requirement. In other words, more money to invest.
What
in the government, blah, blah, blah. Look, when we come back, we'll talk more about this. But I also want to talk about the role of yields in all of this as well. And also whether, you know, it's an area, because it's complicated, isn't it? It's an area whether where you really want, you know, to get retail investors involved and whether they could, you know, get their fingers burnt in this whole process as well. So we'll look at that when we come back. It's the Debunking Economics Podcast. It's me. I'm Phil Dobby. He's Steve Keen. Back in a moment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
It is the Debunking Economics Podcast. We are looking at the UK government's decision, and this has been done in Europe as well. It's not just a UK thing. I'm sure it is in other parts of the world as well. To issue bonds to consumers, to retail investors, rather than banks and financial institutions, so that retail investors can actually be there buying in the initial tranche of shares, the first offering through the allocation process from the Debt Management Office. Is it a good idea or a bad idea? Well, we've said it's a great idea if you want to reduce the amount of money in the economy, but otherwise, you know, there's no problem with banks and financial institutions funding the debt requirements of governments. The question about, of course, you know, the idea behind all of that, as you've described, is the central bank buying up all of that money and putting it onto their balance sheet. There seems to be a lot of resistance to that for whatever reason. And in fact, you know, central banks obviously are trying to reduce their balance sheets now because they're trying to undo QE. So why is this aversion to the fact that central banks can, you know, just basically, in effect, carry this debt?
Yeah, I think it's just having this whole set of interlocking conventional beliefs, which are mythical, about how the financial sector operates. And you have people in positions of power, particularly politicians, but also often bureaucrats who are trained in neoclassical economics, believing like, you know, the chicken. This is why we used to sacrifice virgins to make sure the sun would rise. You know, if you didn't kill a virgin, the sun wouldn't come up, and you couldn't possibly take the risk of not killing a virgin, because then if it was blackness, well, that's it. You know, you've destroyed everything. So let's go find another virgin to sacrifice. It's really about as sensible as that.
Right. Because that does explain the bad weather we've been having in Britain lately, mind you.
And, okay, you kill a few more virgins, but I believe there's lots of them in the young generation these days.
It's fashionable, yeah, there we are. You see, there's a whole new theory as well. All right, well, look, let's talk about yields in a second. First of all, though, you know, there's a bit of a response to last week, wasn't there? Elon Musk and Mars, on both counts. We certainly got people fired up.
We did, didn't we?
So, by the way, if you go to the website, debunkingeconomics.com, no one's ever done this before, but there is a thing you can click on to send a voice message. So have a listen to this one, which came from Greg Harper.
Steve, I've been a long-term listener of your podcasts, and most recent podcast really is disappointing. Elon Musk is an appalling human being with right-wing views on most things and no real concept of environmental sustainability. Full stop.
So there we are, Steve. I think you were standing up too much for Elon Musk last week. That seems to be the message there. But before you answer that, I also got in trouble. Ulf Dahlen on the website said, why is Phil against free speech on Twitter? The one really good thing Elon Musk has done is buying Twitter and firing all the woke censorship crowd. I mean, Steve's economic theories might well have been censored on the old Twitter. Well, actually, the only argument against that is, Ulf, is that they weren't.
Exactly.
But there we are. So I don't know. Is Ulf saying that it doesn't matter what you say on Twitter, you can spread lies from a bot factory in Russia? Does it matter if you use those lies to drive the next election victories and, you know, challenge democracy? Yeah. Anyway. But, yeah, you see, what about Greg's comments on Elon Musk?
I have a very Deng Xiaoping approach to Elon Musk, and that is I don't care whether he's black or white so long as he catches mice. You know, the classic statement, Deng Xiaoping, to get away from ideology and just see what works. I wish that if we hadn't had the neoliberal takeover of economic policy and intellectual framing as well back in the 1970s, which is when it began, we would probably have a NASA outpost on Mars and the moon by now. Okay, so the fact that we had this was kiboshed was due to this whole obsession about government debt, how they have too much government debt, and blaming government debt for inflation, which is where you had the rise of Milton Friedman's approach to economics. One of the many things that destroyed was the NASA program, which the idea of NASA's plan was to establish a permanent base on the moon and then to move to exploration of the planets. Neoclassical economists killed that, as they killed many, many other things. But then
Elon Musk picks it up, and he would. And
50 years, and I don't. I, in some ways, I wouldn't care if it, you know, it was Kim Il Sung.
Well, he couldn't have done it 50 years ago because he would have been five or whatever. But
technology has enabled it. Yeah. The private sector has gone it, and I really don't.
And Elon Musk would say that's a good thing. That's why, because I'm sure he would say he's a neoliberal. So he'd say, well, hey, look what the private sector can do.
Yeah, and they're like Mariana Mazzucato's approach on that, and also Bill Janeway's approach is quite sound in that it says that government will be a loss leader in things like this, doing things the private sector could never undertake when it first began. There's no way the private sector would have got us to the moon in the 1960s. But the technology established by the government at that stage, the huge investment, all those ideas after 50 years finally reach the point where a private individual with large amounts of money can decide to take on space travel. And now we have a space industry, which is becoming quite substantial. My whole thing is, look, this reflects my knowledge on climate and change and the disaster I think we're going to experience courtesy of that. And again, neoclassical economists are responsible there. I just want humanity to have a potential out. And I don't think it's going to happen. Okay, I don't think it's going to succeed. But I thank Christ there's a possibility of it. And that the fact that it's Musk that's doing it, if he's an objectionable individual, I largely don't give a rat's ass. I simply want to have a human outpost on Mars. And people talk about, if they try to do libertarian stuff there, it'll fail faster than you can say Argentina.
Yeah.
Okay. Because the constraints that'll be imposed by being in that environment is so extreme, you have to have 100% virtually agreement with the policies you're undertaking. If you have any discord whatsoever, the social system, if it breaks down in a system like that, then bang.
Well,
you
it's
don't
breaking
have
down here
die.
Anyway, isn't it? Absolutely. Look, just in a more condensed environment. Well, look, let's go back to talking about bonds now, because we're going to run out of time. So look, the thing about yields. So just, I mean, I think most people who listen to this podcast will understand it. But if you buy £1 million worth of gilts, for example, and it pays a 4% yield, then you get 40,000 per year in coupon payments each year for the life of that bond. And bonds are obviously a different maturity. So some are 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and so on. But you'd get the same amount for the life of the bond. If it's 4% yield, it'd be 40,000. But if there's less interest in buying those bonds, then rather than paying for £1 million, you might pay 900,000 for it if there's less demand at the auction. But you'd still get the 40,000 per year because that is what was claimed at the issuance. So the yield, the annual payment as a proportion of the price, will be higher. And I wonder whether that is actually what the government is worried about. That if there's if they get a flood of retail investors bidding in this new gilt issuance, then that's going to keep prices up. so yields would be lower. So the government can issue then lower payouts. When they advertise it, they can say, well, okay, we're going to pay less. And they're going to, you know, as far as the way they'd see it, they can save themselves a few quid. So their liability for future payments is going to be less. I wonder whether that's part and parcel of
Given the people who are thinking this stuff have been trained by neoclassical economists, it's quite possibly something as stupid as that as part of their reasoning. Again, the central bank has the capacity to buy all outstanding bonds today if it wanted to. And that would create 10 times as much money in reserves as is required by the current legally enabled buyers to buy the bonds. It is simply not understanding the capacity of the central bank because the central bank can manipulate the asset and the liability side of its account simultaneously, as a private bank can do, with the added advantage that the central bank does not have to maintain positive equity. And this is, you'll find a paper by, I've forgotten his first name, but Bolat, B-H-O-L-A-T, at the Bank of England, explaining that the central bank does not have to maintain positive equity. So they have none of the constraints that the private banks have, where they must make sure their assets exceed their liabilities. And if they want to buy all the outstanding bonds on the market, they can. And when they do that, what happens is the asset side of the Bank of England rises, which is what QE has been all about. And so does the liability side. And that the liabilities are what we call reserves. We should really call them settlement accounts. So that's what they're normally used for. And then when the Treasury then issues bonds for the current deficit, let's say it's 10% of GDP, there's 10 times as much money as is necessary. Not money, funds. Mm. Now, this is, again, I want to make this point. Money is stuff you've got in a deposit account or in cash. And you can spend, you can buy whatever you like. You can enhance your dildo collection, whatever you want to do with it. Buy shares issued by corporate wankers. Who cares? You can do it. In reserves, and this is the aftermath of the Great Depression, banks are only allowed to buy a very restricted range of assets, which includes, of course, government bonds. So if you have zero reserves initially, but 100 aggregate bonds owned by the private banking sector, say 100% of GDP, then the government, the Treasury the central bank could buy 100% of GDP worth of outstanding bonds, put them on their balance sheet. The private banks now have 100% of GDP in their reserve accounts. Along comes the Treasury and say, we've got an issue equivalent to 10% of GDP. That's, you're oversubscribed by a factor of 10. Mm. And the not understanding these mechanics, I think, is where this nonsense comes from.
Right. So, that explains why they're doing it. But what about the dangers behind it as well? Because I worry about retail investors getting involved in what is actually quite complex. I mean, I do a finance podcast every day and I get confused as all hell by bonds because you're looking at the various yields, you're looking at, the element of future risk, you know, and the reward based against that. Then you're looking at the relativity to other bonds overseas and to corporate bonds. So you're looking at the spread between, 10-year gilt yields and German Bund yields, for example, and between 10-year gilt yields and 2-year gilt yields. Then you've got to factor in the inflation and how much do you think the inflation is going to affect your returns? You know, will the payments you receive at the end compensate for the loss in value of the gilts, based on the coupon payments you've had for the lifetime? It's not like saying, look, I think I'm going to buy a few more Nvidia shares. It is the more complex area of the whole finance industry. And for retailers to play in that, they're just going to get their fingers burnt, aren't they?
Well, I mean, shares are pretty volatile as well, far more volatile than bond prices are.
Well, bond prices have got into that same class now. They've been as volatile as all hell over the last 2 years.
They have been, courtesy of the central banks putting up rates and not realizing what they're doing, both to the income flow, which actually, this is where Warren Mosler's point comes in. If you're increasing the interest rates on new bonds, then you're paying people more money. You've gone from, say, a 1% yield to a 5% yield. You're giving a substantial amount of money to people who own bonds, normally those being banks and non-bank financial institutions and some wealthy people. So you're doing, giving a stimulus from the higher interest rate. But what you're also doing is devaluing existing bonds. And this is the point you made earlier in the podcast, that if old bonds are offering 1% and new bonds are offering 5%, then those old bonds have to be devalued to the point where their 1% paper yield becomes equivalent to 5% on the Yeah. And that devalues the, and that's, we're actually seen that happen quite dramatically in the value of bonds owned by, I've seen the data for America here. In effect, if the banking sector in America was required to have record all bonds in what they call mark to market, that would mean that they had been, the entire financial sector would be insolvent, because the value of the assets they own would have fallen so much that their liabilities would exceed their assets. There'd be negative equity, and that's the definition of bankruptcy for a bank. So it is very dangerous to be playing with these interest rates. But for the individual buyer, if you're buying like a short-dated government bond, then large variation in interest rate have a very small effect. If you buy long-dated bonds, the longer the date is, the more inverse relationship is between interest rates and the value of the bond. So you could face, like, if they were selling consoles, for example, being bonds that are never repurchased, they have an infinite life. Then if there was an interest rate increase by a factor of five, the value of the console would fall by a factor of five. So you might have bought a console for 1,000, it's worth 200, you've lost 800. So there is that potential danger for retail buyers getting involved in it.
Even without retail buyers, and by the way, retail buyers can be involved in it, just in the secondary market. I mean, you can buy EFTs that cover government bonds. But of course, we saw, during the Liz Truss presidency, that we had, the Bank of England having to step in because the value of bonds had fallen so much. They had to buy in to get those yields down and to get the value back up again. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, pension funds would have collapsed.
Yeah, but the thing is that again shows the capacity of the central bank to intervene in the secondary market, and also they can't buy in the primary market. The legal restriction is that the people who buy bonds in the primary market must be authorized dealers and banks which have accounts at the central bank. But the central bank can buy on the secondary market, which already has, 10 times as many bonds outstanding as any deficit you might imagine would be available. And then by making that transaction in the secondary market, they provide the primary dealers with all the funds, not money, all the funds they need to buy the bonds which are on offer for the current deficit.
So why are they doing it then? Is it just the misunderstanding of the way the system works by and large?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I can't see any other reason.
Well, another reason might be that they're thinking, well, hang on a second, there's so much money swimming around in the finance sector now. There's more and more money being saved as every year goes on. Is that all going to find itself in the share market, and then we're just going to have asset prices in the share market increase? Or more dangerously, if we've got the US share market doing so well, we're going to have a flood of all this money going overseas, which would shrink our UK money supply. So they worried about that. And so they said, oh, God, we've got to offer more opportunity to retail investors within this country. What can we do? I know, we'll let them buy government bonds. Could that be part of it as well?
That's about the only sensible reason I can think of to enable this in the first instance. Mm. So, yeah. But like my problem
is... And even then, you could say, well, they can still buy on the secondary market. You can still buy EFTs. So
yeah.
Why?
I've bought shares. I have bought bonds on the secondary market way, way back in 1993. And I'm embarrassed to say this, but it's true. My then wife asked me to buy a property. And I said no, because the Sydney property prices are in a bubble, and I refused to ride a bubble. Right. Stupid old me. I should have done it on the speculative
Consequently,
way.
You're not married to her anymore. Yeah.
Well, that's another story. But different cause there. But anyway, what will you do? I said, I'll buy government bonds. So I bought $200,000 worth, Australian dollars worth, of, as it happens, Queensland state government bonds, because I believed interest rates were going to fall over the subsequent period, which of course they did. Hmm. So they went from about 6% to, when I sold them, about 2%. So I gained about $30,000 or $40,000 profit on the value of the bonds that I purchased. But this was actually me, and I remember being challenged by an Austrian economist on a discussion group I was part of at the time. He said, well, at least you put your money where your mouth is. And I said, yes, I expect rates to fall because private debt is going too high. Higher private debt will cause interest rates to fall over time because of the unsustainability of that level of private debt. And bang, that's one of the elements of my experience in the lead up to the financial crisis. So there's no necessity for it in terms of financing the government.
Yeah.
And this is why it's so irritating to hear this stuff being said. It's only people who swallowed a neoclassical textbook, and frankly, what they should have is an operation to remove the textbook from their esophagus rather than making decisions like this.
Right. And the upshot of it is, at a time when the country is struggling and, you know, we'd say we need more money in circulation, what it's going to do is withdraw money from circulation. So, I'm not quite sure whether it's going to be the uptake's going to be significant to have that big a difference, but who knows? So here's just before we go. So similar but different. So the government is also saying, hey, we've got all these NatWest shares. We want to sell off NatWest now because, of course, they bailed out the NatWest group during the financial crisis. Have been hanging on to those shares for a long time. Now they're saying, oh, we want to divest all our shares and we want to make, you know, we want a strong retail participation in that share. So I'm imagining a bit like, do you remember the Telstra share offer in Australia where every other ad on TV was buy Telstra shares? So maybe they got the same idea for NatWest. So, because, you know, if you sell it to the public and they don't know what they're buying, then you'll be able to, you know, push the price up. You know, use government money to push the price up so you get a better return. I'm not sure that should be allowable, but that is obviously what goes on. And in Australia, the share price was sold well and then went down, and a lot of people got their fingers burnt there. But what happens there? Does that have any influence on them? I haven't thought this through at all, but I'm asking you to do the thinking for me, as usual. So the government holds those shares in NatWest. It sells them to the public. Is that just an asset swap? Does it influence the money supply in any way?
It would reduce the money supply because the assets... it depends on if it's just the Treasury or the central bank that holds the assets in that case where you bought NatWest. I presume it's the Treasury.
You think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you're then selling those shares, I mean, I need to then do the quadruple entry necessary to work this out properly. But that's ultimately that's going to reduce the amount of money in private bank accounts. And therefore, that's reducing the money supply.
You wouldn't want to do that in a hurry, would you? Because it was, I remember the third, the third tranche of sales for Telstra, and it was getting close to the deadline for the payments. And it was about, I don't know, $6 or $8 billion suddenly sucked out of the economy as everyone went to pay for those shares at the last moment. So when you have big movements for lots of shares, if they're trying to do it quickly, that could have quite a profound effect. Again, if they're doing it now in an economy that's struggling, seems like very bad timing, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's typical of neoclassical economists. Oh, so frustrating.
There we are. We'll end it there. It's so frustrating.
Yeah. Good point. It is.
All right, very good. We'll catch you again next week. I've got a whole load of topics to talk about, but they're starting to. But if you're listening and you've got something you do want us to talk about, get in touch with us or leave a comment or whatever. We do listen and happy to, you know, take ideas as well. But we'll catch you next week. Thanks, Steve.
Welcome, mate.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to to listen.